Public Radio KMXT is supported by a grant from North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations: Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas & Go at the Y, and Gas & Go at Mill Bay.
It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station. We're broadcasting up here on rather gray, overcast Signal Hill, where it is 32 degrees. They are showing wind speeds from the northwest at 12 miles per hour out at the airport right now. And the Weather Service is calling for a 40% chance of snow showers today, mainly, well, before noon. Mostly cloudy skies with a high near 37 today. West winds to 20, decreasing to 15 this afternoon. For tonight, just a slight chance of snow showers before midnight, then a slight chance of snow after midnight. Mostly cloudy overnight tonight with a low around 30. Calm winds are expected to turn to the west after midnight. For tomorrow, a chance of snow before 9 a.m., then a chance of rain. Mostly cloudy skies tomorrow, too, with a high near 41. Light and variable wind will turn to the south to 10 tomorrow morning. And for tomorrow night, we're looking for rain before midnight, then just a chance of showers after that. Southeast wind to 15, increasing to 20 tomorrow night.
Especially in large minority communities, that their voting power could be in jeopardy for generations to come unless Congress acts. NPR's Scott Detrow reports a Democrat visits Atlanta tomorrow to rally public support for election and voting legislation, running into Republican opposition in the evenly split Senate.
The first one has gone by a few different names, but it's really, by and large, a sweeping bill that would set national standards for early voting, voting by mail, voter registration. It would try to limit partisan drawing of legislative lines. There's another one called the John Lewis Voting Rights Act that's a little more limited. It would essentially strengthen the Voting Rights Act that was weakened by the Supreme Court about a decade ago. And that would really be a way for the federal government to respond to this wave of voting restrictions that have been passed in Republican states.
NPR's Scott Detrow reporting. In defense of the state-level restrictions, Republicans argue the integrity of future elections is at stake. Efforts to tighten rules began prior to but picked up steam following former President Donald Trump's defeat in the 2020 presidential race. The U.S. and Russia laid out their concerns in a high-stakes diplomatic meeting in Geneva today. Russia wants guarantees that Ukraine will never become part of NATO, but Washington won't make any guarantees. Here's NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says there was no progress on Russia's main demand, but he says he did spend a lot of time in the talks in Geneva, laying out Russia's concerns and the urgency of the situation. For her part, Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman calls the talks frank and forthright.
Today was a discussion, a better understanding of each other and each other's priorities and concerns. It was not what you would call a negotiation.
She says negotiating new security arrangements for Europe will take time and would only succeed if Russia de-escalates. Russia has tens of thousands of troops along Ukraine's borders. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Record warmth across the U.S. last month made 2021 one of the hottest years on record and also one of the costliest for climate-driven disasters. NPR's Lauren Sommer has more from a new report out today from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
NOAA says December closed out at almost 7 degrees Fahrenheit above average in the U.S., making it the hottest December ever recorded. That helped make 2021 this country's fourth hottest year in the past 127 years of record keeping. The six warmest years have all occurred in the last decade. The U.S. also saw 20 weather-related disasters that cost more than $1 billion last year. Worldwide, extreme weather cost $280 billion altogether, according to a report from Munich Re. Scientific evidence shows that floods, hurricanes, and droughts will likely continue to become more extreme as the planet gets hotter. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
It's NPR.
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
Every year around the holidays, birding enthusiasts across the Western Hemisphere take part in the Christmas Bird Count. They document birds within a 15-mile radius over a 24-hour period. The observations are shared with the Audubon Society and can provide vital information about local bird populations and habitat loss. This year, Kodiak Island held its main count on December 18th. A smaller second count was held last week on a different part of the island. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports that the results paint an incredible picture of local biodiversity.
Rich McIntosh has been birdwatching on Kodiak Island since he moved here in 1973. That was the first year he organized the island's Christmas bird count. And as memory serves him, the weather doesn't always cooperate for count day.
I remember one count we did quite a long time ago, and then in the paper the next day, there was a photograph of a car that had been down on the docks that had a 2x4 flew through the air and punctured the front window of a vehicle. That was kind of indicative of what the weather was like on count day.
Fortunately for McIntosh and the 77 other volunteers who joined in this year's December count, conditions were ideal for spotting birds this year. The winter sun beamed from behind a wispy patchwork of clouds, and temperatures were in the high 30s. The group documented 82 species, from yellow-billed loons and trumpeter swans in the waters just outside of town to ptarmigan in the surrounding peaks. The total number was nearly 14,000 birds. McIntosh says that rich assortment is incredibly unique.
Not all years, but most years, we have the greatest species diversity in Alaska. The other locations that have good diversity are all coastal.
Homer, Ketchikan, and Juneau also tend to see a wide array of birds on count day. But Kodiak is special, according to Robin Corcoran. She's the bird biologist at the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. She's also on the board of the local Audubon Society and took a research boat from the Wildlife Refuge out on Chiniak Bay for this year's count.
Birding tends to be somewhat competitive. And so for us, it's our pride and joy that, you know, in winter, Kodiak is this great place to be, just because we have an opportunity to see so many different birds.
That's partially because of migratory patterns. That means birds like emperor geese, which breed in the Yukon Delta, make their way to the Aleutians for winter. Kodiak is at the northwestern edge of other migratory birds' ranges, too.
We're sort of just in this weird central placement out there in the Gulf of Alaska that we get this sort of cool east-west blend of things that are just surprising.
Birds that aren't seen on count day can also be just as important as ones that are. The group didn't see a belted kingfisher this year. According to Corcoran, that's only happened twice in more than 40 years of Christmas bird counts.
I think if you go back and look at the data, it's going to be how cold we were early in the season and all the fresh water froze up. And I don't know what happens to them, but the belted kingfishers just sort of drop out of the population.
That's useful habitat data for the Audubon Society and for local bird watchers. McIntosh says there's a few types of birds that have only been spotted once during all his years organizing the Christmas count, like the snowy owl.
All those are very rare here. Some of them are rare in Alaska, and others are just rare in the winter.
A find like that comes with special bragging rights for Kodiak bird watchers, according to McIntosh, and it's another reason to keep counting. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Omicron is now the dominant COVID variant in Alaska, and it is changing the way the health department looks at the pandemic. As KTOO's Claire Strempel reports, the state has new recommendations about how to gauge your risk.
The state's public health officials say that the level of granular data we had at the beginning of the pandemic is pretty unusual. Now, they'll be tracking COVID-19 more like they've always tracked the flu. looking at trends over time.
Things are changing rapidly here in the state of Alaska.
As the state's case counts reach an all-time high, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Ann Zink says the metrics public health is using to understand the virus's spread and severity have changed. For example, the percent positivity rate, that's the percent of all the tests for COVID-19 that come back positive, used to be a good way to get a sense of the virus's hold in the community. The higher the number, the more testing needed to be done. But that's no longer the case.
It really is kind of changing in its usefulness. If we have a lot of people doing at-home tests, we always struggle with some of these smaller facilities in getting reports in.
Zink says it's better to look at the total number of positive cases, which is still an indicator of risk and community spread. But state epidemiologist Louisa Castrodale says now we need to look at those numbers in broad strokes instead of worrying about daily counts.
Whether we give you a number that is like, you know, 1435 versus 1537, like it's up. That's good. That's what we want people to take away from it. Knowing that we have community spread, that's sort of enough to help educate people into what they might want to do for mitigation.
Public health officials say contact tracing isn't so useful anymore either, and they're phasing it out. The state hasn't hammered out the full details, but they say they will be getting rid of some of their contact tracing staff. Here's Castrodale again.
Way back when, it was super important to know exactly where that person had traveled and exactly where that person had been because there were so few cases and there really wasn't community transmission.
In other words, contact tracing was useful in interrupting the spread of the disease. Now, Southeast Regional Public Health Nurse Manager Sarah Hargrave says Omicron is moving too fast to catch every case before it spreads.
So when we have a huge number of cases, we really want to focus on those that are the newest because they would have had less chance to spread it around to other people. The ones that are already 10 days out, like they've spread it everywhere or as far as they're going to at any rate.
Hargrave says public health is triaging contact tracing. Instead of trying to reach everyone who's positive, the state will first contact the newer positive cases and people who are at high risk or live in group settings like homeless shelters, mines, and assisted living facilities. As the state changes how it tracks the pandemic in Alaska, local community leaders are having to change how they track it, too. Hargrave says they should be looking at case counts and vaccination rates as they make public health decisions. State epidemiologist Joe McLaughlin says for people trying to make decisions about their personal level of risk, the most accurate metrics are the number of local hospitalizations and deaths. Case counts are still useful, even though they aren't as accurate as they were before, because the state isn't getting data about all of the positive test results now. In Juneau, I'm Claire Strimple.
Bills to bring back political campaign contribution limits and change how Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation board members are appointed were among the legislation filed ahead of the upcoming session. There were 43 bills and 5 constitutional amendments proposed by House members and 15 bills and 1 amendment proposed by senators. Anchorage Republican Senator Roger Holland proposed a bill that would prevent legislators from receiving per diem payments if they fail to pass a budget by the 121st day of the regular session.
There's incredible motivation, or there could be incredible motivation, for people not to finish the budget on time, to collect per diem.
Per diems would resume after they pass the budget, but would not be paid retroactively to cover the time between the session end and the budget passing. Legislators passed a law in 2018 saying they couldn't receive per diems until after they pass a budget, but lawmakers and the legislature's legal advisor interpreted it to mean that they could be paid per diems retroactively once they passed the budget. The law's sponsor said that was not the intent of the bill. Legislators' per diems could be reduced under a recent proposal by the State Officers' Compensation Commission. Different bills would raise legal limits on campaign contributions to individual candidates. That previous limit of $500 was struck down by a judge for being too restrictive. Anchorage Representatives Andy Josephson, a Democrat, and Calvin Schrage, an Independent, and Democratic Senator Bill Wilichowski proposed the bills. Another bill would create a new committee that would appoint the public members of the Permanent Fund Board. The governor currently appoints all of the board members, but the bill would give the legislative leaders a say as well. The bill would also expand the number of public members from 4 to 6 and increase the length of their terms from 4 years to 6 years. Josephson proposed the bill. Other bills include measures to protect the fund that pays for university scholarships and grants, as well as for medical education, and increase the pay of state workers, as well as change the permanent fund dividend formula. Few pre-filed bills have become laws in recent years. The session is scheduled to begin January 18th. The trial starts this week for the man accused of murdering another student in the University of Alaska dormitory 28 years ago. KUAC's Robin has this report.
Jury selection is scheduled for this morning in the murder and rape trial of Stephen Downs. He's now 47 years old and is charged with killing a fellow University of Alaska Fairbanks student, Sophie Sergey, in April 1993. Downs has spent the last 3 years in custody while his trial was delayed by the pandemic and the court system being hacked. But Judge Thomas Temple has heard in that time more than 28 hearings to mete out the value of evidence or theories of how the crime was committed. Jury selection was scheduled for last week, but postponed until today after one of the defense attorneys tested positive for COVID-19. Sophie Sergey was a 20-year-old marine biology student from the Western Alaska village of Pitkus Point. Although she was not enrolled at UAF that semester, she came to Fairbanks for medical appointments and was spending the weekend with friends in the Bartlett Hall dormitory on the UAF campus. She was found the afternoon of April 26, 1993, in a bathtub at the dorm. She had been stabbed, raped, and shot. Troopers interviewed students in the dorm and many others. Genetic samples from the crime scene matched no suspects at the time. The case was cold for decades, until 2018, when the Alaska State Troopers Cold Case Investigative Unit tried a new DNA matching technique against commercial databases where people voluntarily submitted DNA profiles. Investigators came close to matching the crime scene DNA to a profile from a woman who is related to Stephen Downs, who was an 18-year-old freshman at the university at the time of the murder. Downs was arrested in February 2019 at his home in Maine and extradited to Alaska in August that year. Defense attorneys from Maine have argued that other people could have committed the crime. Last month, Judge Temple allowed the defense to suggest three different alternative suspects in their arguments. The alternate theories of who committed the crime may make this a lengthy trial of several weeks. The public will not be allowed into the trial during jury selection. Opening arguments may not start before midweek. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
A Fort Wainwright-based soldier was recently found dead at his home. A U.S. Army Alaska release says the 40-year-old 1st Striker Brigade Combat Team Master Sergeant Wesley Woods was declared dead at his off-post residence December 30th. It says the cause of Woods' death is under investigation by the Alaska State Troopers and the Army's Criminal Investigations Division. Woods was from Mississippi and joined the Army in 2001. He served two overseas combat tours and was the recipient of numerous medals. His most recent assignment to Fort Wainwright began June 2018. Wood is one of 13 Fort Wainwright soldiers who died in 2021. Six of those deaths have been ruled suicides as of mid-December. The race to Alaska is back on. The unpowered boat race from Port Townsend, Washington to Ketchikan will start June 13th after 2 years of cancellations because of pandemic-related border closures. Race boss Daniel Evans says organizers are glad to revive the seven-year-old tradition.
We're really excited to come back up because we just want to kind of reignite all of the energy that, you know, we've had there for all these years because we've been gone for 2 years.
Evans says nearly 40 teams have signed up for the 750-mile race already.
It's going to be great because it's a collection of some teams and people who have done it in years past. Katie Stewart, who's going to be doing it for her fifth time, and Team Oracle, who they've raced every year in the Race to Alaska. But we also got a really exciting team coming up called Rite of Passage, which literally it's a collection of youth starting at 15 and topping out at 19. There's four of them.
Evan says a couple of Alaska teams have signed up as well, including Team Dark Star out of Talkeetna. It's a unique race in a world where sailboat races are governed by ever more complex rules. Evan says the single-class regatta is a way for people to test their own limits. He says in years past, it has featured everything from rowboats to kayaks to multi-hull sailboats.
I sometimes say that it's like the way to celebrate the everyday heroes. And it's those people, your neighbors, the people that pass you in the street, that you would never guess can do such amazing things.
Registration is open now at r2ak.com through March 15th. As always, the first place prize is $10,000. Second place is a set of steak knives.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the art of all things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
With the holidays approaching and the celebrating escalating, I think we should take a moment to talk about imbibing responsibly. Alcohol is a factor in 60% of fatal burn injuries, drownings, and homicides, 50% of severe trauma injuries and sexual assaults, and 40% of fatal motor vehicle crashes, suicides, and fatal falls. At blood alcohol 0.02, drinkers begin to feel moderate effects. At 0.04, most people begin to feel relaxed, mildly euphoric, sociable, and talkative. At 0.05, judgment, attention, and control are somewhat impaired. Ability to drive safely begins to be limited. At 0.08, this is the legal level for intoxication in some states. There is a definite impairment of muscle coordination and driving skills. 0.1, this is legally drunk in most states. There is a clear deterioration of reaction time and control. 0.12 to 0.14, vomiting usually occurs unless this level is reached slowly or a person has developed a tolerance to alcohol. Drinkers display emotional instability, loss of critical judgment, impairment of perception, memory, and comprehension. When you reach 0.18 to 0.25, drinkers are disoriented, confused, dizzy, and have exaggerated emotional states. Death may occur at 0.37% or higher, and at 0.45%, this is fatal to nearly everyone. So be safe, and thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon, and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 10th day of January, the year 2022. The sun rose today at 9:46. It will set again at 4:48. That will give us 7 hours and 1 minute of daylight, a gain of 2 minutes and 46 seconds compared to yesterday. A record low for this date was 4 degrees set in 1932, and a record high was 47 set in 1916 and 1930. Currently 32 degrees, and they are showing wind speeds from the northwest at 12 miles per hour out at the airport right now. We're looking for a 40% chance of snow showers today, mostly cloudy skies with a high near 37, west winds to 20. Slight chance of snow showers before midnight tonight, then a slight chance of snow after midnight, mostly cloudy skies tonight with a low around 36. A low around 30, rather, tonight. And for tomorrow, a chance of snow before 9 a.m., then a chance of rain, mostly cloudy skies with a high near 41 tomorrow. Light and variable winds turning to the south tomorrow morning. Looking at our local tides, we have a low tide coming up here on the east side. That is going to happen at 2:45 this afternoon and be 2.2 feet, followed by a high tide at 8:32 p.m. of 5.4 feet. Your next low tide will be at 1:55 a.m. and be 2.8 feet. And our high tide for tomorrow morning here on the east side will happen at 8:45 a.m. and be 7.9 feet. Over on the west side, that low tide is coming up at 3:15 for you this afternoon. It'll be a 3.6-foot tide in Larson Bay, followed by a high tide at 8:53 p.m. of 9.2 feet. Your low tide for the middle of the night on the west side will be at 2:44 a.m. and be 4.6 feet. And your high tide for tomorrow morning will be at 9:09 a.m. and be 12.5 feet in Larsen Bay. Looking at our marine weather, mariners for Marmot Island to Sitkanat, Kodiak's east side offshore, small craft advisory through Tuesday. West wind to 25 knots, becoming southwest 15 this afternoon, seas to 13 feet. For tonight, south wind to 20 knots, seas to 11 feet. And for tomorrow on our east side, southeast 20, seas to 11 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, we have a gale warning for today with north winds to 40 knots. Should come down to the west to 30 knots this afternoon, seas to 10 feet, subsiding to 4 feet sometime this afternoon. For tonight, southwest 15 and seas to 3 feet in the Shelikof. And for tomorrow, east winds to 20 knots and seas to 4 feet. The Kodiak Public Library will be closed through January 31st due to staff shortages and the community-wide spread of COVID-19. However, curbside service is still available for borrowing materials, IRS forms, copying services. Please reserve materials through their online catalog, and that can be found on the City of Kodiak Library website. Or you can call them up at 486-8686 for service. Call them Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Also, magazines are available through the Alaska Digital Library on the Libby app and may be borrowed like an ebook. Over 3,000 magazines are available. You just need your card and PIN number. Just call the library about this free service. Their number again, 486-8686. The Kodiak Fish and Game Advisory Committee is having their election and meeting today at 5:30 p.m. That's happening at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Conference Room at 351 Research Court. The purpose of the meeting is to hold elections for members and officers and to address Board of Fisheries shellfish proposals. The meeting is open to the public, and all residents of the area who attend the meeting and are of legal voting age may make nominations and vote on committee membership. There is a teleconference access and a code to get. For more information on that, call Taryn at 907-842-5142. One additional item has been placed on the agenda for the Board of Education special meeting that's occurring at 1 o'clock today. That is 4.03, reconvene in public session to conclude the hearing. A special meeting will be held in the District Services Conference Room, that's F-140 of the old high school wing. The meeting will also be streamed through BlueJeans, and login information can be found on the Kodiak Island Borough School District website under the Board of Education tab. Kodiak History Museum, Kodiak Arts Council, and the City of Kodiak is inviting artists to submit qualifications to design an outdoor public art installation in downtown Kodiak as part of the Kodiak Asphalt Art Initiative. The artwork will be located in an area near the ferry terminal parking lot, including nearby crosswalks and sidewalks, connecting the terminal and visitor center with the museum district. The primary goal for the project is to revitalize an underutilized public space, creating a pedestrian plaza for visitors and locals alike to enjoy. Artist submission deadline is January 21st. Complete details of the project and the artist submission process can be found online at the Kodiak Arts Council website. That's at www.kodiakarts.org. And the Kodiak Arts Council is presenting International Guitar Night. That's happening next Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. Four guitar luminaries will showcase the diversity of their instruments. They include Thu Lee, Lolo Reinhardt, Luca Stricagnoli, and Janet Negrero. For more information and to get tickets, go to the Arts Council website at www.kodiakarts.org. And the Women's Resource and Crisis Center will be having a regular monthly meeting of their Board of Directors at 6 p.m. Tuesday, January 25th. Guests are welcome. Call 486-6171 or email them at contact@kwrcc.org for more information on how to attend.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.